Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-5121, Cynthia Artis et al. Appellants versus Ben S. Bernanke, Chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. Mr. Charlton for appellants, Mr. Wilner for appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Walter Charlton for the appellants, and I have the honor of having with me this morning a new member of the bar, Lynetra Artis, who happens to be the daughter of the lead plaintiff in this case. Today, I represent 16 putative class representatives with a putative class of about 350 people. Appellants ask this court to reverse the lower court's dismissal of this case based on non-cooperation. The board's claim of non-cooperation during counseling is factually untrue, as five sets of documents of record are contained in the appendix and record. Now, no hearing of any kind, that is, no evidentiary hearing to resolve disputed facts, ever occurred.
There's extensive discovery taken of these meetings, right, of the critical meetings.
There was highly limited, I think the judge's strictly limited were his exact words, discovery was taken on the sole issue of whether counseling had occurred or not. Now, it is my belief, as I stand here today, that the government has conceded the fact that some counseling occurred, because that brown folder there contains counselor's reports, and so I think we resolve down to the issue of, was the counseling sufficient? Now, we claim
meetings took place, right? Meetings took place. But the question is whether it was the type of counseling that the statute and the regulations have in mind, right?
I think that's correct. Yes.
Did you now cite specific evidence of completed counseling in response to the motion to dismiss?
I'm sure we did. We filed a great number of documents, and all of the documents were before the court, and one document in particular, a letter from Mr. Bransford saying that I had interfered with counseling Mr. Wilner was questioned about it. I was questioned about it. But nothing was admitted into evidence at all. But the record is large, and the documents are there, and we specifically said and alleged over and over that we had exhausted counseling. Now, here is the problem as I see it. What do you mean by when you say you have to sufficiently exhaust counseling? Well, the cases say that it's counseling that would give the agency an idea of what your complaint is about. So you really have to start at the tail end of this thing. This complaint started off in 1993 with a class action filed by three African-American ladies and grew from that point forward. The first case was dismissed without prejudice. We came to the second case, and the ladies with counsel demanded counseling. And counseling did, in fact, occur. Now, the counseling that occurred, when they went into counsel, they had filed a class action. So they were attempting to counsel on class action issues, and in fact no class action issues were ever counseled, even though EEOC Judge John Fallon ruled that thou shalt cancel. It didn't happen.
But isn't the whole idea behind class action is that you have to start with the individual. The individual has to show how she has been aggrieved.
Right? I agree with that, Your Honor.
And did they do that here?
They did that here. Yes, they did.
Because opposing counsel claims they didn't. That
well,
give them specific
attached
information,
to our...
That some of the folks wouldn't even give them names of supervisors that the board could check with.
Your Honor, the venerable case of Klassen, Phillips versus Klassen, says that if one, you have to have one class representative who has exhausted. It is my belief, in a fair hearing of any kind, it would be found that approximately four of our people could not possibly be denied that they did in fact counsel.
Which
now,
four?
Now when I
which
I,
four?
The two attached to the brief, which are Dory and Carter.
I thought the issues that were raised by the two of them were more than 45 days before the session, and thus wouldn't meet the specific kind of dates, actions, and what have you that's required at a counseling session.
I'm glad you raised that question. What happens at the Board of Governors is every year the same claims renew. That is, every year there's a reevaluation, performance appraisals, you get your bonus, you get your raise, or you don't get your raise. This pattern of never, ever promoting a black person, African-American person, to a supervisory position has been ongoing for 30 years. Every year, if you view this as a class action, which they filed it as a class action, if you view it as a class action, every year, every single one of these people suffered the same repetitive denials. And the statistical principle of the inexorable zero applies in this case. It's almost unbelievable that no black clerical supervisor has ever been there. Maybe still, I don't know. But when, as far as the testimony of my 16 people that's in the record and in the documents, there's 204 man years of observation, and it just never happened. Now, when you come around to the question, which is, did they counsel? Absolutely, every one of them counseled as to the pattern practice, because the counselor, Rosemarie Nelson, a very fair person, said, I've been ordered not to counsel on the class issues, and we have an affidavit in the record to that effect. However, what you can do, and what I'm asking you to do as your counselor at the board, is to submit in writing a description of these class issues and sign it. So all these 16 putative class representatives did that.
But I think we still don't have the answer to the question of whether or not this was timely.
It was timely because as a repetition every year, it was timely. And when we went back to have our, we had a class meeting for counseling purposes, and it turned into an individual session, and Kim Hardy was interviewed by William Bransford by the counselor at that session with everybody present, and William Bransford admitted that interview, and Kim Hardy specifically was talking about the timely things that had just happened, and so was everybody else. So,
yeah, pardon me.
I have here Donna Dory's face sheet from her counseling report, which is one of the pile, and it says, date of alleged discriminatory event, January 8th, 1997. That's on the counseling report. So that I may be mistaken because so much time has gone by, but I think every single one of these alleged a timely complaint, and nobody has ever raised the issue of untimeliness before. Ever. This is, the question was, gee, we didn't do it right. And we say we did all we can do. Now, I want to mention that under the standards that I'm aware of, Rule 9C, requires a condition precedent, which this is, to be generally alleged, but how you went wrong has to be alleged with particularity. So I see my yellow light's on, and I wish I could go on for another hour.
Well, I had one more question, which is this whole thing seems to have stemmed from confusion, perhaps, and it might have been strategic decisions about what to say at the counseling sessions. And the people in question seem to only want to talk about the class allegations and not what happened to them individually. And I guess Mr. Bransford, at the end of the second session, specifically said to you that he was willing to extend the counseling period, at least he says as much, in order to permit the EEO office to request and obtain further information that you had asked for, and that you declined that opportunity.
That's correct, and we did extend it, and we did counsel. All these counseling reports are long after that date. So it did occur. The counseling did occur. There's no question.
Counseling, but there was information you wanted, I gather, you wanted information that the board had about salaries and promotions.
We asked about 10 times, Your Honor, for the disclosure of the electronic files so we could specifically say what happened to each person, not just these 16, but the whole 350 of them.
Right.
And they denied this.
It offered, as I understand it, to extend the time for you to get that information, but you declined that.
No, that is not correct. That is absolutely not correct. The reverse is true. Always, they totally denied access to the data. Mr. Bransford said, you have to do this, even though our time for fulfilling the requirements has expired. You have a requirement to individually counsel. And it was individual counseling, and we did it. And here are the counseling reports. Now, back to your first question, which I don't think I've properly answered yet. Not only were they timely, but the two attachments that we attached to the brief are the best of the 16 as to their individual values, violations. But another thing that was distressing about this case, the complainants elected and informed the board that they wanted counsel present at all the counseling sessions, because after all, this was our second time around. We'd been dismissed for not doing it right, and they wanted counsel there. Well, they went ahead without counsel present. That was me. And so I wrote a very strong letter saying, counseling, this is during the after the period that you asked about. This is the period where the dates are on the counseling reports. So after when that occurred, I wrote a very strong letter to Sheila Clark, and I said, look, they want me present. I'm supposed to be present. You're going ahead without me. That's not right. So counseling shall cease until it's corrected. And it did cease. And then it was corrected. And the result is the pile that's here. So that the timeliness is just, it's irrelevant. And I think it's, if there ever was an argument, it's been long waived long time ago. But the sufficiency, I think, is the thing. Now, the question really comes, if you're going to apply Rule 9C, we have fully met our burden. And we say we couldn't have done, these 16 people could not have done anything more, with one exception, I think, who was out ill at the time and never did go. And so I think the more appropriate question is, specifically, what did we do wrong? What did all these people do wrong? And I don't think they can answer that question, Your Honor. I would hope to be able to have a minute or two to rebut. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Ken Wilner with Paul Hastings, Janowski & Walker, and I'm representing the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve this morning. With me today are Catherine Wheatley and John Curry, in-house counsel with the board. We're here today to talk about counseling, and I want to start by talking about how important counseling is to the federal EEO process. It is central to the functioning of that process because it is the way that the board is able to learn what the complaint is, to talk to the complainant, understand what the problem is, and then investigate it.
Isn't your opposing counsel right that the real question for us is sufficiency? I mean, counseling at some level, meetings took place, right? And so now we're in the area of trying to decide whether the meetings were adequate. And what's our touchstone there?
We do agree that the issue is whether the meetings are adequate and that there were meetings that took place. The touchstone is whether the information that was provided, as and this is in Artis 1 as well as Kizus and other cases in this court, the touchstone is whether the information that was provided included specifics of details, time, place, and what happened. For example, in the case of a promotion, as this case concerns, all the person has to do is to say, I applied for this specific job on this date, this person got it instead of me.
You don't think it would be sufficient to say in 30 years there's never been an African-American clerical supervisor and I'm one, what's going on? That's not sufficient?
No, that's exactly the kind of generality of bare notice of what the complaint is that is not sufficient according to Artis and to Kizus, because it doesn't give the board the opportunity to investigate specific things that did happen.
Well, no, there's a claim that for 30 years there's never been an African-American clerical supervisor. That's pretty specific, right? And so you look at that and you say, oh my gosh, that's right, or no, it's not right. Here's why it's not right. Why isn't that required of the board in a counseling session?
Well, for example, the way that the board would investigate something like that would be to find out what openings did this person apply for who's seeking to represent the class? Did they apply for any? And why was a person who was selected? And if you have multiple people coming in, as was the case here, then you would investigate with respect to multiple people, and you would see if there's a pattern that emerges as to what they applied for, what they did or didn't get.
It says that for four folks they did that they gave you that specific information. What's your response to that?
We don't believe that they did, and we especially believe that the record shows that no evidence of that was given to the district judge at the time of the decision. I would urge the court to look very closely at docket number 42 in the district court, and that is the appellant's opposition to our motion to dismiss that was filed. It's 10 pages long, and in it there is not a single reference to any specific. He referred to Ms. Dory, for example, today. There's no reference to Ms. Dory contained within those 10 pages. What the appellants did at that time was to point the finger at the board and say, the board prevented us from counseling. It was all about Ms. Nelson's affidavit, which we've shown in her deposition testimony, tells a different story than it was described at that time. It was all about the allegation that they were supposed to be given data, which the Artis 1 court has held that we were not supposed to do. There's nothing in there. There was nothing given to the district court. After the district court ordered discovery and gave them the opportunity to gather the evidence that might support them and then to present it to the district court, there's nothing in there about the presentation of specifics by the counselees.
Was this record before the district court?
The district court was presented the 10-page document. Might there have been other things that were presented to the court earlier with different pleadings, perhaps, but it's not the responsibility of the district judge to go look through, at that point, many years of filings and see if there might be something that the plaintiffs failed to cite and point him to that might support them. What the plaintiffs presented to the court simply didn't contain any assertion that there was individual satisfaction of the counseling requirement with individual details.
Not one.
But they did say that they had completed counseling. Perhaps they did not say that they had completed individual counseling. But do they have to be that specific?
Their argument actually was primarily that they were prevented from counseling, which would not implicitly suggest that they had completed it. It's that they were prevented from counseling. We've shown through the deposition of Ms. Nelson and other people that were present and the complainant's own admissions and deposition that, in fact, they were not obstructed at all in counseling. Ms. Nelson testified that what her instruction was to have group sessions and then follow them with individual sessions, and she testified that, in her view, that was absolutely the right thing to do because in group sessions, people are reluctant to say things. In individual sessions, they're more likely to communicate, and she can better keep a record of what happens.
I want to go back to this whole question of counseling. Because, you know, one question that I have is the question that counsel ended with, which is, what did they do wrong? How much more would they have had to do to satisfy this counseling requirement? If the point is that the department should know what the claim is so that they can investigate it, what more did they have to say?
What they did wrong was to make a strategic decision that it would help them in the Artis One case, where they were arguing about the motion for dismissal in that case, by not giving individual specifics. And then to come into the counseling and give only, to use their words, word for word, comma for comma, identical boilerplate descriptions of general claims, and to refuse to say, I applied for this job and I didn't get it, and that, John or Jane...
Keep going, sorry.
And that John or Jane, whoever, got the job instead of me, and this is a supervisor who made the decision. That's all they had to do, was to say...
Okay, well, let me follow up on that, because I have two questions about that. One is, this is a class claim. And because it's a class claim, that what they're claiming here is systemic bias. In that department, and they were saying that it was happening to all of them across the board. So in one sense, it seems to me counseling has to be responsive to the kind of claim it is. And it seems to me the department is saying, no, even if you're making a class claim and even if it's about systemic bias, you've got to give us, I can see how that is anecdotal, but the real question would be statistical, wouldn't it? As counsel says, the inexorable zero. Why isn't that enough to put the department on notice of what the claim is?
The counseling regulation itself, when one looks at the class part of the counseling regulation, it's section 204, 12 CFR 268.204, it refers back to the individual counseling section. So the regulation itself specifies that the counseling for class issues relies on the individual counseling section. So the regulation and its own structure makes clear that individual details are required, and this court has held that in Artis 1, as well as in other cases such as Kiesis versus Webster. Simply making a broad generalization that there is a class issue and it affects everybody is exactly the sort of specificless allegation that in Artis 1 this court held is not sufficient.
Well,
because
let me ask you about something specific. There's a counseling report in the record. It's at JA, it starts at 230. And at 231, Dory says that among the clerical staff, white counterparts are pre-selected for advancement. They are informed of openings while black secretaries are not so informed. Managers help them. And when there is a qualification, like a college degree, they're allowed to apply for those opportunities even when they don't meet the criteria. And she names a specific person. Why is that not enough?
She names Karen C., as my recollection, Your Honor. And what is, for example, not present in the counseling report, because it was not said in counseling, is when that happened. There's no indication that happened, for example, within 45 days, nor is there any indication that Ms. Dory actually applied for that job, nor that she was in any way qualified for that particular job. To say that something happened without saying when and without saying it affected her is not sufficient to constitute counseling in our view. Had she said that she applied for that job and it happened within 45 days, of which, by the way, there's no evidence in this record that it happened within the 45-day counseling period, nor that she applied for it, then if she had given that information and who the supervisor was, and go talk to the supervisor to find out what happened.
You know, see, it seems to me you're setting up a really impossible kind of hurdle here, because she's saying, I didn't apply for that job because the job said the qualification, the minimum qualification, was a college degree. I don't have one. But somebody who doesn't have a college degree was nevertheless selected for that job. But you're saying if she didn't apply for it, she can't complain, right?
In the ordinary case, when someone doesn't apply for the job, then typically that person is found not to have been in the pool and applied for it and not to be able to bring a claim on that. Now here, as Your Honor points out, she says she didn't apply because she didn't have a college degree. There's nothing about, however, that having taken place within the time frame where it would have been timely. So whether, even if she it's sufficient for her to have said, I didn't apply for it because I was deterred, because I didn't have a college degree. If that happened more than 45 days beforehand and there's no evidence that it was within the time frame, it still is not sufficient for counseling because it's not sufficient for a claim.
Has the department ever raised this timeliness claim before?
Yes, Your Honor. It's actually in our appellate brief, and it's also it's also in our opposition to the motion for reconsideration below. And that's a big part of the problem here, Your Honor, is that these issues were never raised until the motion for reconsideration by the plaintiff appellants in this case. They're not raised in the briefing on the motion to dismiss, and therefore we're not responding with specifics as to things that were not raised at that time. They were raised on the motion for reconsideration, and we did respond with respect to timeliness in response to the motion for reconsideration.
I thought part of the issue here was not just failure to promote, but also discrimination in the pay.
As the appellant has stated, for example, at page 8 of their brief in this court, as we understand it, this case is primarily about promotions. We do recognize...
Perhaps primarily, but in the original complaint, it seemed to cover both promotions and existing pay. And to the extent you're complaining about existing pay, I don't know how you're supposed to complain any more than to say, I'm getting paid less than someone of a different race because of race, which seems to have been alleged at the counseling sessions as a group matter.
It's not something that is alleged that anyone said in the opposition to the motion to dismiss, docket number 42, which is what the court had in front of it for its decision. I do recognize, Your Honor, that there is in the complaint and other places as well an occasional comment or in the complaint and allegation that there is pay discrimination.
It's systematic. So we're getting paid less because of our race. We're not getting opportunities to be promoted. We're not getting cash bonuses. We're not getting grade step increases. It's really across the board, the allegations, right? And as to some of those, for example, promotions, you would need an individualized claim. I take your point there. If I applied for this position, didn't get it. But as to the base pay, it seems to me if you just say I'm getting paid less because of my race, then you have to come up with the statistics, which I guess, you know, would have been the next step in this.
With respect,
I don't know what more they could have said. Going off Judge Brown's point, I don't know what more they could have said as to the pay than I'm not getting paid as much as I should have, and it's because of my race.
They could have said, as an example, I'm not getting paid as much as John Doe or Jane Doe.
How will they know without, this is the conundrum, how will they know without seeing the pay information that Mr. Bransford was asked for?
And at which Mr. Bransford, as was pointed out by Your Honor correctly, and I would direct the court to Joint Appendix 145, 378, and 379, the board did ask to extend the counseling in order to get data and to be provided, and that was denied. But in terms of a pay complaint, it is common that an employee will say, I believe I'm paid less than Jane Doe or John Doe. And they'll have some idea, they may be right, they may be wrong, but in order to be able to assess whether someone's right or wrong, and whether there is a claim, an employee who wants to counsel will have some idea of who, if anyone, was paid more than them. Because if they just say, well, I think maybe, you know, I'm paid less, but I'm not going to identify who, I refuse to tell you who is paid more than me, I refuse to give you any specifics.
Then the agency could just maintain for decades a systematic system, a system of pay discrimination, and no one would ever know about it, and there'd be nothing anyone could ever do about it.
Well, people always do talk about their pay, and in practice, people talk about their pay.
Well, maybe in some agencies, yes, some agencies, no. I don't think you can state that across the board.
I guess I'm just relying, Your Honor, on my experience generally, that people do talk about pay, and the person doesn't have to be right. The person could say, I believe John Doe is paid more than me.
Well, that's what they said here.
How does that give you, the department, the ability to investigate that claim any better than simply saying, I believe that systematically African-American employees are paid less? I mean, one of the claims here is we routinely get less successful evaluations. And the result of that is we don't get these bonuses and we don't get awards. What more does the department have to know than to look at that?
Let's talk specifically about the evaluations. In the record, we have affidavits and testimony that the evaluations were done in October and the first few days of November. And I can give some sites for that. For example, for Ms. Dory, who was mentioned specifically. That's more than 45 days in advance. Therefore, that couldn't be the basis for counseling anyway. And I'm afraid I'm losing track, Your Honor, of the rest of your question.
Well, my question is simply that it seems to be sort of catch-22 for them. They are making a class claim about systemic bias. They are saying that if we get lower evaluations, then it follows that we get less money, we don't get these bonuses, and so forth. And all of that follows from the initial bias. And you're saying, unless you can point to specifics, there is no obligation on the part of the department to look into this.
We're saying that the way that a compensation claim, for example, in litigation is typically advanced is for people to say, here are comparable people to me who are paid more than I am, based upon their experience, based upon what they do. And the board would then look at who those comparable people are. And what the counselees here did not do.
Did they do that by basically saying all the white people in the same positions?
Well, these are people in multiple positions at multiple levels of secretary, for example. And
okay,
I would point out
that wouldn't have been. I mean, the board is a finite place. It wouldn't have been impossible to gather the information for all those employees. Mr. Bransford had even offered to do so.
It would have been impossible to gather the information for the people whom the counselees believed were comparable to them. We could have,
right.
Because we didn't know who those people are. We know who other people are. We know who the hundreds and hundreds of secretaries at the board are, but we don't know who is the person that Donna Dory thinks is comparable to her, who's getting paid more than she is, and that's something that she knows, but she would not tell us.
I don't know.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
If the board, you know, looked at this, looked at their personnel records, and found that in fact, if you compared overall the salaries of their African-American clerical employees and the salaries of their Caucasian clerical employees, and there was a huge gap, isn't that at least an inference of discrimination?
Now
maybe you can explain it away, but doesn't that at least create an inference?
If the board, had, Your Honor, had gone out and undertaken statistics to compare people's salary, and if the board had the data available to identify factors that would affect compensation, such as a person's pre-board experience, their experience while they're at the board.
You would do a regression analysis. That's exactly how you do it. You would look for what is the most potent explanatory factor, right? People do that all the time.
That's something that could.
Why wasn't that triggered by them coming in and having the counseling session saying there's systemic bias here?
If the request is why wasn't that given to the appellants in this case, it's clear under Artis 1, for example.
That's
not the question?
Not
okay.
Why you didn't give it to them. The question is why that wasn't enough for you to investigate, because that's all the counseling is about, isn't it?
Counseling is about investigating and giving the board an opportunity to learn about the specific claims of the individuals and to resolve it with them. If we had looked at those statistics, that might have given us some insight as to what average pay was among different groups of people. That would not have enabled us to be able to talk to Donna Dory and to say, well, here are the people that you say are most comparable to you. We've talked to the managers about why this specific person is paid this specific amount, and we can explain whether it is or it isn't a problem. And if we'd done that for 13 people or 16 people, however many that there were, we could have gotten a sense as to whether there was a problem that's not just based on statistics, but based on the real world of these specific people's claims.
What if the Dory or someone doesn't know for sure, but suspects that similarly situated white secretaries are getting more and doesn't know for sure which names to list, but has a pretty good sense that across the board they're being paid more?
If Ms. Dory had come in and had said, I think these three white employees are the ones who are similarly situated to me, and they're paid more than me. This is current. This is now. This is within the last 45 days, and we all have the same manager who made the pay decision. Here's who the manager is. That would have been sufficient, but that did not happen. What happened instead was a boilerplate, identical word for word, comma for comma description of the general allegation of that there's a difference in treatment, and that's exactly what.
Jen, that was probably to preserve the class, I assume. I mean, I assume that was a strategic decision.
It's certainly our belief that it was
as opposed to having individual cases are not as potent as a class action, as you're well aware.
It's certainly our belief that it was a strategic decision to do that in order to try and make an argument in the Artist One case that was pending on a motion to dismiss it at the time, and that it wasn't the intention to come in to counsel to give the kinds of specifics that would enable the board to resolve it, but rather to try to generate a record for Artist One. For example, during the first counseling session, counsel for the appellants did pick up the telephone and call Judge Norma Holloway Johnson and say, we're here to try and fix the deficiency in Artist One. That's why we're here. They left that message for her. That's our belief as to what was going on, not an intention to try and resolve the issue.
Is there a good explanation for why this has taken 15 years from, and we're not even out of the starting blocks?
The case, Your Honor, was first, the first motion to dismiss was filed, if I recall correctly, in 2001, and it may have been earlier than that. There was a substantial period of time before a decision. That decision was to deny the motion without prejudice and to order discovery. That decision, if I recall, came in roughly 2003. The discovery took place in 2004. The renewed motion to dismiss was filed in 2005. The dismissal came in 2007, the order on the motion that was filed in 2005, and the reconsideration order was in 2009. So that's the time frame that explains why it took so long.
All right, Mr. Wilner.
Can I ask a question just for my general education? Private counsel is representing the board here. How does that? I don't know how the board normally goes about doing this, but that just educate me. Why aren't we seeing Justice Department lawyers, for example?
Yes, Your Honor. The board has independent litigation authority, and therefore the Justice Department has never been involved in this particular case, and the board litigates many of its own cases.
Thank you. Right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Wilner. Mr. Charlton, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I appreciate the 2 minutes. In attachment, Donna Dory's report, page number 0016, I think perhaps Mr. Wilner has misspoken. The date picked by the counselor's report on that page, 0016, is January 8th, 1997, the date the merit increase became effective across the board. That is, October's one date, but the law and the regulations allow you to get 45 days from the date it becomes effective. That date was, according to this evidence, and they're all the same. So they're all timely. Timely didn't happen. I mean, errors in time did not happen. Two persons admitted on the board staff admitted that, or the equivalent of admission, that counseling did occur. One of them was Barry Taylor. Barry Taylor was a supervisor of counselors. The final line in his notes, which are in exhibit, says counseling did occur, counseling is completed. The other one was, of course, the affidavit of Rosemary Nelson, which was their counselor, who essentially adopted the status of, or became a whistleblower. And the last 10 pages of her affidavit are revealing about the board's policies and practice for the 30 years. I don't think I have anything else.
Can I ask you one question? One thing that concerns me about the second counseling session is that, according to Mr. Bransford's affidavit, you repeated at the second counseling session the generalized assertions and demanded access to statistical information concerning secretary salaries, promotion, and performance evaluations by race, which seems to me entirely appropriate, that you wanted to know the information that I was just having the discussion with the other side about. And then the next, according to Mr. Bransford, in view of Mr. Charlton's request for statistical information and in light of the fact that the 30-day counseling period would expire in 2 days on February 15th, I asked that the counseling period be extended to permit the board's EEO office to consider a request and obtain the information if appropriate. This is the statistical information that would have either shown the claims not to be meritorious or would have given your claims shown them to have some merit, in which case the board could have responded if it chose administratively. And then it says, Mr. Charlton declined my request for an extension. The counseling period expired before the board's EEO office had an opportunity to respond to the information request. In other words, as I read that, the board wanted you to make individualized allegations. You refused and said, no, we just as a matter of course, the African-American employees are getting less pay, less opportunity. We want the statistics to show that. And the board said, okay, we'll give you the statistics, but we're going to need an extension. And you said no. Why did you say no, and why isn't that a problem as we sit here today, unfortunately, 13 years later?
Your Honor, my only response to that is that that is a non-candid series of events. That never happened. To the best of my recollection, sitting right here today.
Which part didn't happen? Did you ask for the statistical information?
We asked for the statistics repeatedly, okay, and repeatedly they were refused. And if they had said, we will give you the statistics if you wait, we would have done anything. The statistics is the whole ball game here.
And I understand that.
And
that's
therefore,
why I'm very focused on this paragraph, because it seems that the board was offering to try to get that information to you, in which case this could have been resolved administratively or try, you know.
Your Honor, I didn't write that paragraph sign that paragraph. I'm telling you that is a non-candid paragraph. It never happened. Okay, and that's not the only thing non-candid about this case.
What if that did happen?
Well, I should be disbarred if that happened. That's ridiculous. Your Honor, it's standard procedure for the agencies to withhold the goodies. And that's what they've done.
I'm aware of that, yeah.
Barry Taylor told me in his deposition, mm-hmm. I said, do you have the statistics? He said, sure. Do you have it all electronically? Do you have it in database format? I asked him a whole bunch of questions because I'm a CPA. That's what I used to do, is build these things. And he says, sure, we got them. I says, well, how long would it take you to get them? He said, depends, maybe 3 hours. You know, I'm getting this kind of response. And he says we didn't ask for them. I can hardly control my blood pressure. I'm absolutely serious. But this problem, I don't want to deviate. This problem of not giving the goodies, the statistics, is not limited to the Board of Governors. I'll just say that much because I got three or four more cases in the pipeline coming to you right now. And it's the whole key to the thing. I mean, you know, if you don't get the statistics, we were cooked to start off with. So I would never say such a thing, ever. And I challenged them to show a transcript or a piece of paper or anything. It never happened.
Thank you, Mr. Charlton.
Can I have 1 minute, Your Honors, to point to the record citations that address Mr. Charlton's comment?
It'd be useful.
Okay. Just no argument.
No argument.
I would direct the court to Mr. Bransford's affidavit, which Your Honors are aware of, as well as Joint Appendix 378 to 379, and also docket entry 23, which is the stipulation pursuant to which Mr. Bransford, in order to avoid his deposition in the case, I'm sorry, Mr. Charlton, in order to avoid his deposition in the case, said that he would not in any proceeding make representations as to what happened in the proceedings. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.